Welcome. I'm Jessica Teigen, and this is the Evolving to Exceptional podcast, where we talk about reaching peak performance in our workplaces, homes, and communities so that we can live our best life possible, an exceptional life. I want to welcome our Evolving to Exceptional listeners back to another week of the Evolving to Exceptional podcast. We are going to dive in today a little bit more into some of those challenges that people are experiencing today and the challenges with boundary setting and having that emotional intelligence and navigating a lot of the workplace issues and the impacts of those on our mental health and on our ability to manage our effectiveness in the workplace. And I have a fantastic guest with us today. And she is a director of human resources and recruitment and has been in the HR benefits recruitment space throughout her career and had a really interesting pathway and background to her current position and a passion for people. And I would love, Alisa, for you to tell us just a little bit more about yourself and how you got to where you are and why it is you do what you do.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Jessica. So I've been in human resources for over 10 years. I started in benefits and just really learned the human side of things as far as how much people need benefits, the personal side of their health conflicts and how it affects works and how much having those great benefits at work really do improve people's lives. From there, I went to an HR manager and I managed a security multi-billion dollar company for about 2.5 years. And then I moved back into benefits at another multi-billion dollar company. And then from there, I moved to an HR director role, which is where I'm currently sitting at now.
So tell me a little bit, having had such a background in like kind of the benefit space, what is it that really attracted you to the space in particular? And what is it that you find most interesting or challenging about the space?
Yeah, so for me, benefits is just such a wonderful way for companies to help their employees on such an official level. So not like ordering pizza or like doing a special Friday thing. It's something that they can offer their employees that truly improves their lives and mental health, especially if you start getting into the EAP programs and making sure those are readily available and known to your employees. So often companies will have an EAP program and the employees either don't know about it or don't know how to use it. So for me, it was just getting to be a partner with the employees and improving their physical and mental health so that they can do their work better and they have a better work-life balance.
I love that. And I think that oftentimes we can underappreciate the importance of true benefits, not just the pizza parties and the impact that those have and why they're so meaningful and why it matters to put some thought and intention into those and into which ones you choose and why you choose them.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
So tell me a little bit about what some of your biggest challenges either have been over the last year or the challenges that you're facing right now that you're trying to address in terms of your workplace and the people and employees in your workplace and what your current experience is.
Especially, I would say over the last 2 or so years with COVID hitting, all of our employees are remote. One of the biggest challenges that I faced is explaining the benefits we do have to employees so they can take full advantage of them. Many of our employees, they're all clinical, except for the corporate side of things. They're very busy. Their schedules are all over the place. It's very difficult for them to hop on a computer. That's not where they normally work. So just making sure that our employees have a culture of they can come to me, I'm readily available to help, and here's what you guys can sign up for, and this is the best way to use it within your own personal life and situation. So just making sure, it's like herding cats with having so many remote workers, but just making that extra effort to make sure that one person or two people or three people who haven't reached out to you know that you're here and willing to help and to make sure they understand.
So what have you experienced that you think is important to the growth or the management of your organization where either employees are struggling or you're struggling to figure out what the next way of working or how to do it more effectively in that remote world and in the environment that you're operating in now?
I would say making sure people have a work-life balance with COVID and everybody staying home, I think the majority of people realize the importance of not working your life away and to be home with your family and be present when you are home. So one of the big things that I've really been pushing for with my organization is a healthy work-life balance. What does that mean to that person? Is it spending 2 weeks away and 2 weeks at home? Is it spending a few hours during the week every day, 7 days a week? What does that look like? And accommodating those schedules and then just making sure that the culture stays intact during all of the inconsistent scheduling, employee recognition, and just making sure that employees know that they can have that flexibility all the while not micromanaging as well.
So what do you find their responses to be in that dialogue or in that discussion? Is there consistent answers in terms of what people want in terms of that work schedule or work environment? Are you allowing all of that flexibility? Are you just considering those alternatives? What are you seeing in terms of that focus?
Yes, like I mentioned, our clientele is CRNAs and nursing. They're in a clinical setting. So they do have that flexibility to choose that schedule because some folks want to work 7 days on, 7 days off. And that's because either having kids or children with disabilities or spouses with disabilities that they need their help on a longer stretch of time. For the majority, we do accommodate that as best that we can and as best as the facility or hospital allows. There's really not much that we haven't been able to accommodate, especially on the corporate side of things. Some people like to work 6 hours, 7 days a week, or 5 hours, 7 days, whatever it is. Some people like to work 10 hours, 4 days a week. As long as the work is getting done, that's really what we're trying to measure against. Is there any performance issues? Are they showing up to meetings when they're supposed to? Are they attending what they're supposed to? So as long as all of that is being met, we're really accommodating what works best for each employee.
That is so powerful. And I think unique because a lot of workplaces don't have that flexibility or are maybe not even willing to consider that flexibility, even if they could have it. I'm curious if you've seen that positively have an impact for people and whether people really know what works best or are they still in that pilot, let's try this phase. What has that experience been like?
That's funny you say that because a lot of previous employers, that's actually why I left my previous employer. They just were not willing to budge on it moving forward and what this new world looks like at pre-COVID or post-COVID. For us and our company, I would definitely say pilot mode. We are trying and adjusting and tweaking here and there, even down to the location. Something that works for somewhere on the East Coast may not work for something on the West Coast for whatever reason. So we're constantly adjusting just what and how we manage those schedules and those accommodations. But overall, I can see that employees are so much more happy just because of that work-life balance. Their mental state is not as stressed. I can tell when I talk to our employees, it's not as tense. They're a little bit more willing to say, hey, I'm a little bit frustrated here. What can we do about it? Because they know that we'll work with them. So I would say it's absolutely had a positive impact. I've seen people come over to our organization because they've heard that we do have such a great work-life balance versus other companies who are just not willing to make that change and stay up with the times. So absolutely positive.
I think that can be so impactful. And at the same time, flexible hours alone don't necessarily create the perfect environment all on their own, even though that's been helping and that's been impacting. What have you seen in terms of people's mental health challenges? Do you feel like they're doing well? Do you feel like that's still a struggle? What are you seeing in terms of, especially since you are in that health care industry space that everyone is talking about? It's top of the news cycle right now in terms of RNs wanting or needing different having different needs with respect to how many patients they have and what hours they're working and being short-staffed and all those challenges that are in that space. What are you seeing in terms of the toll that's taken on people and how they're coping or managing through that?
I will say one of the biggest challenges that we've come across is managing the facilities itself because we only have control over our employees, the anesthesiologists. We do not have control over the hospitals, other doctors, the surgeons, the facilities. And so really managing those relationships or helping our employees manage relationships with who they have to work with that we have no control over has had a really big impact. One of the things that I've implemented the beginning of 2023 is quarterly check-ins. And it's just one question. It's an email that gets sent out to everybody and it's, how are you doing? And they click the link and it has five steps. I'm doing great, all the way down to I'm doing very poor. I would like HR to reach out to me. I've gotten amazing feedback, even comments saying, thank you for checking in. Like just that little appreciation of saying, I appreciate you asking how I'm doing. Nobody ever does. We've gotten comments that say, I am doing poorly. Can we please have a meeting? And that's one of the biggest ways that I've gotten to know our employees is by saying, I see you're struggling. Let's set something up. How can I help? And that's just really had a really great, impactful, positive force on our employees and just helping manage those relationships that they may not feel they would have been able to manage otherwise.
So what comes of that process? They put that information in. Who gets that information? Who follows up on that information? How many are you seeing people say, I need a call from HR? Like, I'm really struggling. Like, what are you seeing in terms of what you get back in that information and what you do with it?
Yeah. So I would say, first of all, I get it back. So I send it, I create it, I get it back. It's all anonymous unless they want to be known. So if they do click, I would like HR to reach out. There's a field to enter your name. And that's how I know to reach out. I have had a couple instances where employees will say, yes, I do want to reach out. It's truly anonymous. And if they didn't put their name, I just send an email and say, hey, somebody wants me to reach out. Please let me know who you are. I can't reach out without knowing your name. I would say the majority, probably 3/4 of our feedback is positive. I'm doing great. I'm doing pretty well, something to that effect. Of course, we do have 25% who are saying it poorly or, you know, I need HR's help. A lot of the times employees will say I'm doing poorly, but they don't want HR to reach out. So that's, for me, that kind of means they're either really struggling and don't want to be identified. And I try to do a blanket look across the company. Do we have any pain points that I'm aware of? Is there any one facility that maybe we can focus on for a second and see if that kind of helps this anonymous person? But depending on what their needs are, I do try to handle those internally within HR. On occasion, leadership needs to get involved or their managers need to get involved. And that's strictly just like I've had my work would be drastically improved if we have this new machine. Okay, great. That's not something I can buy. That's not, you know, something that has to be talked about with the clinical side. So that is something that would be brought in by leadership to try to help with and see what we can do to improve their work.
So what if you've got somebody who's really struggling, who has responded in that way? What are the steps you take with them as you reach out to them? What do you offer in terms of support? And how do you navigate those challenges?
So if I do have an employee who's truly struggling, and we've actually had employees who somebody's passed in their lives, somebody's very ill, something like that. The first step I go to is our EAP program, which is our employee assistance program. They offer free counseling, free financial help. They even do wills and trusts, which is really neat. That can put ease of mind for some people. They can go over your finances. They can help with deaths and families, stressful work environments, just everything. And they're just great. So that's normally where I first direct them to. I do follow up on a weekly basis, just say, hey, how's this going? Do you need any other resources? Is there anything else I can do to help you here? And luckily, it's been resolved fairly quickly with the EAP program and just me following up and helping manage whatever is happening in their work life that I can help with. On one instance, we did identify that this person may need to have some time off. So we allowed them to take a break, a week off, which we accommodated, and they came back very grateful. So just managing what we can and helping where we can, but we absolutely turn to our EAP program first.
So I'm curious about that because most organizations do have EAP programs for supporting employees. And I find, or at least I found in my career, them to be extraordinarily underutilized, that employees just have, I don't know, a resistance to, and I think that's part of the reason EAPs can remain as inexpensive as they are, because they are so rarely utilized by employees. Has that been your experience as well? And do you feel like employees get what they need ultimately out of it, or it's just a first step?
I do think they're very underutilized. That has been my experience with my previous companies where I wasn't in a leadership position. Once I became a director and I could really advertise that, that's what I've started doing. On a quarterly basis, I send out an email, hey, friendly reminder, we have an EAP program. Here's how you access it. Here's the brochure. Here's their number. And I do really try to push it because I think it's a great resource. Now, I don't think it's an end-all be-all. I do think it's a first step. So that's, they're taking that initial step to get help. Again, it's free. So if they find, oh, you know what, this counseling really is helping me, I'm going to go seek out somebody else. And if they do, and I've actually, in my previous company, I have helped people seek out somebody who's in their network or somebody close by and then gave them some phone numbers and they've called. But I do think that the EA program is a very resourceful and helpful tool when it's utilized correctly, but I don't think that it's a final step. I just think it's there as a stepping stool.
So as you're navigating those experience, those challenges or those situations with employees, have you found there to be any common themes or experiences of people, or are they all really uniquely different, challenging situations that they're navigating or experiences that they're having?
I would say there's an umbrella. The majority of stress that I see from our employees is that work-life balance, right? Like, I have young kids. I just got married. I have a son who now needs some medical attention. So it comes from, I'm scheduled to work 40 hours this week, 50 hours this week. But I'm also, I'm a mom, I'm a dad, I'm a parent, I'm a son, a daughter. I need to help my parents. So the umbrella I would say I see the most is managing their family. But within that umbrella, they are all very unique situations. I can't think of two situations that have been very similar. It's all been very unique.
So let's dive into that work-life balance piece a little bit. And with such, almost the term itself is a misnomer because there is no real delineation between our work and our life. We live one life and work happens to be an aspect of it. And yet somewhere along the way, we almost, and maybe it's in the term itself, develop this belief that it's between these two things. One of the things I like to say, because we practice from a neuroscience and neuroperformance perspective, we talk a lot about our bodies and our brains and how they work together. And the reality is that we take our bodies everywhere we go. And so whatever experience our bodies are having in the different parts of our life, we can't actually take that out of our body and compartmentalize in that way. In fact, it's actually detrimental in some cases to try to do. And that creates, I think, what it sounds like you're experiencing as well, a lot of challenges for people in trying to figure out how to create a boundary or to delineate between two things that are really a human construct, really a way of wording or trying to make things be separate that are actually the same. I'm curious as to your thoughts on either your experience with that or your experience with that with employees and what you have seen or observed in that space.
You are absolutely right, especially with our remote workers. All of a sudden, you live at home, you work at home, you're taking care of your children at home. Everything's at home now. So it's really hard to set those boundaries of, okay, I'm now in my workspace versus now I'm in my living space. No, it's all combined. One thing we really encourage is, what is it called? It's like the one-on-one off. You work an hour, you take a 10-minute walk, you work. So we really encourage getting up and moving. Another thing we've tried to do as far as the physical aspects, we've partnered with a gym. So all of our employees have a code that they use with our company and they get a discount at the gym. And we really encourage them to use that. And we advertise that, especially with new hires. Hey, don't forget, you have this code. Please get out, be active, take care of your body just as much as your mind and set those boundaries at home that allow you to work efficiently while also being able to care for your family and whatever that looks like for you.
What do you think the adoption rate is of people either using the gym memberships or stopping to take those breaks? What do you see in terms of that?
I do know the breaks. We have the corporate side who are all remote. We have a very early meeting every single morning. It's called our huddle. It's just our catch up of the day. And I will say the majority of people during that meeting are walking, myself included. It's been structured that way that, hey, let's during this meeting, go outside and get a walk. So that I will say, has been very impactful and very helpful. And I think it has to do as well. It's the group. You have your group, even though you're remote, we're all walking. That has helped. The gym piece of it, unfortunately, I don't think it's utilized as much as it could be. We're really trying to see if maybe we add another location or maybe another facility, or we are looking into tweaking that up for the 2024 year to try to improve those numbers. But we do try to really encourage some sort of physical activity.
So what I love about that, if we look at that through a neuroscience lens, if we take a minute to just unpack what you're doing there, when it comes to the performance of our brain and our body, it requires blood flow. It requires oxygen. Like the neurons in our brain require that replenishment, that source of nutrition, in order for them to fire and work appropriately. And one of the things I didn't recognize for a number of years is that when we don't get up and move, that oxygen, those nutrients actually deplete. And so we say anecdotally, you need to move, you need to get, not necessarily even exercise, but you just need to get your blood flowing. And we say that kind of from like a health and nutrition perspective, but not necessarily thinking about it from a brain performance perspective. And that the longer that we go without moving, without getting the blood flowing, without getting our heart pumping, even just a little bit to increase that oxygen and blood flow, the more our brain is going to strain to make those neural connections. And I think that plays out in people's performance and their level of energy towards that performance as mm-hmm. they continue to push through, go from one meeting to the next meeting to the next meeting without taking that time to replenish.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree that we absolutely push it a little bit more in the corporate side of things because, of course, our clinical side, they're on their feet all day long. I can see how maybe after being on your feet for 12 hours, you don't want to go to the gym. You're tired. You want to sit down. So maybe just figuring out, right now I'm actually looking into more of a yoga studio because you're off your feet, but it's more of a relaxing body movement than, say, working in a hospital and walking those halls for 12 hours straight. Just trying to fit the best needs of our employees. And the gym may not be it, but we are exploring other options for them as well.
You know what that makes me think of, actually, especially for those that are in that clinical setting, because they are on their feet all day, because they are using their bodies all day, they're actually getting probably a pretty significant amount of movement in terms of steps and in physical movement. And what their bodies may actually need more than additional exercise or movement, even yoga, which I agree is not quite as strenuous, maybe some strategies around nervous system regulation. Because when you're serving in a clinical setting and you're interacting with patients and you're interacting with doctors and you're around people that are probably really struggling in a lot of cases or have in really stressful situations, especially if you're dealing with anesthesia and there's a lot of risk in that and you're having to pay a lot of really close attention and things like that, that to help people with strategies on how to regulate their nervous system. So as they come home, how do they move out of that? Or how do they move through those different states throughout the day so that their body isn't getting worn down and more exhausted by being in that fight, flight, sympathetic, dominant state all of the time?
Yes. Yes, I can see that. Maybe even some meditation of some sort. I've heard companies paying for apps that focus on meditation and to help calm the body and calm the mind. So something to look into for sure.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Meditation is such a great method for self-reflective awareness and introspection. And nervous system regulation can actually happen in very short periods of time. So you don't have to go do a 10, 20, 30 minute meditation to regulate your nervous system. You can do it in as little as 3 minutes.
And so,
So as you learn those approaches and those techniques, it can make a big difference for people. And it's certainly, I'll speak to my own experience of being able to recognize those states and shift out of those states allows you to get back into a better performing state. And when I say performing, I don't just mean in the workplace. because we have roles we have to perform at home too. So coming home exhausted, completely depleted, unable to rally for the things that we have to do at home can also be impactful.
Yes, absolutely. And I will speak to myself, but I know meditation has also helped with managing those work relationships and even extending to my two young kids and my husband, managing those stressful situations. It can really help keep everything from, like you said, the fight or flight.
Yeah. And I think it's something that it's interesting because I think my sister's a nurse and a pediatric nurse practitioner. And despite all, even in the medical field, despite all the medical training, I don't know that there's a lot of awareness of those components on their own performance or on in their own lives, despite all of the education from a service perspective for the patients.
Yes, I agree. Yes. Oftentimes just being in human resources and looking from the outside in, it can really help address some of those, I don't want to say issues, but maybe some of those just actions that maybe they're not being aware of and helping them reflect on those and improve those.
So you talked about earlier the individuals and you're having to sometimes help them navigate the challenges or the cultures or the environments that they're working in because they're not necessarily, you're not necessarily managing those cultures, right? Mm-hmm. They're not your company's culture. They're where they're working, right? Where they're operating. So I'm curious what you've seen in terms of people coming to you and you having to get engaged there in those cultures. And what are some of the challenges? Are they toxic cultures? Are they just dysfunctional? Are they, is it just one-on-one, a specific person issue? What are there any themes at all to what you're seeing as you're helping people to navigate those challenges?
I would say the biggest theme that I've seen is lack of communication. And that's by no means a specific person's fault. But when you enter these organizations that have hundreds of people working and a lot of, it's not one entity. It's all these people are coming in. So the anesthesia department is one contractor. Maybe the surgeons are from a different contractor. It's all these entities coming together under one roof, having to work together that with somebody they've never maybe even seen. We have a lot of PRN folks now who prefer PRN. So you're working at one location one day, a second location another. You're meeting all these new people. So just lots of personalities and lots of moving parts. And so the biggest struggle is that communication of, okay, this person's in charge. This person is doing this. You need to reach out to this person. So one thing that I've started doing for each location or trying to keep up with doing is making those charts for our new hires, but also making it available for the current employees as well. I've called it Who's Your Team Flyer? And I try to make sure they have a picture, their title, what location they're at, but also, you know, what they're there for. Sometimes a CRNA may have hired a chief CRNA. You can go to them for scheduling or if you have conflict or something like that. And then even further, you have an MDA who is going to further manage that conflict. And if that's, here is the human resource number. Here's the payroll number. Here's the leadership's number, our CEO's number. So really just making them aware of where they are, who their team is, how they can get those results. And if they do have a problem, to try to manage that and get that early before it becomes a bigger problem.
So interesting that communication remains such a challenge despite everyone knowing
all the
importance.
Yes.
And that we need to have it and all of the dialogue around effective communication and the training on communication. And it almost gets me to think that, and I often say this when it comes to specific skill sets that people don't demonstrate, despite knowing that they should or knowing how to do it, is that there's something in terms of their neurophysiology that is preventing that effectiveness or is preventing those outcomes. And maybe that's just embedded a bit into some of the cultures that then it gets carried on without people even necessarily recognizing it or paying attention to it.
Yes, I would absolutely agree that a lot of the times it's not intentional. It's not somebody being mean or aggressive or passive aggressive, anything. It's simply, I didn't know that so-and-so needed to know this. or oh, I was aware, but their personality is just, they don't want to deal with conflict and they're afraid to either say, oh, I saw this happening or to speak up. Most of it is not ill-intentioned at all. It's just finding those comfortable avenues for people to be able to communicate in the way that's most effective for them.
So tell me a little bit about, we talked a little bit in our prior conversation about understanding our emotional intelligence and our emotions and our boundaries and how that comes into play for not just your employees, but maybe for yourself as well from an HR perspective, and why it's important to talk about and to consider those topics in the workplace today.
For myself, boundary setting is a big step for me simply because there's always work to be done. And so being able to say, okay, it's 5 o'clock now and I need to spend time with my family, or maybe that's not necessarily something that is appropriate for me to handle. Let me get you to somebody who can. So setting boundaries for me personally is just making sure that I'm managing my time and how I spend it. I know that can also reflect on some of our employees within their facility. A lot of the surgeons will ask our anesthesiologists to stay late, and that's not part of their agreement. That's not part of their contract. So setting those boundaries with those individuals as well to make sure that they're sustaining their work-life balance and to make sure that their time is spent where it was agreed to be spent. For me, the boundary setting is just such a big component of mental health and having that healthy work-life balance.
When we talk about boundaries and we look at it through the neuroscience lens, we talk about safety being a part of our gut brain, our neural networks that are in our gut, our safety, and then our gut is also responsible for taking action and our core identity. And so we'll often talk about boundaries in that context, that boundaries are really the come out of our gut brain and our gut brain's ability to set healthy boundaries, because sometimes we set or have boundaries that are not productive or not effective. And then it really depends. And I go back to that core identity of our gut, because it depends a lot on how we grew up, and how we learned and how we developed our neural pathways, on our ability to set the right boundaries or to have the right boundaries or even to understand what boundaries are. Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit to what boundaries look like and why you found them to be important and how you've maybe put some into place?
Sure. Yes, absolutely. For me, a lot of it goes, I rely not just for myself, but for all of our organization heavily on job descriptions. That is where the majority of my boundaries come from. This is what I'm here for. Not to say that I don't encourage being a team player and helping out, but setting that boundary of this is what I'm here for. This is what my expertise is. This is what I'm getting paid to do. And setting those boundaries to reflect that appropriately and just kindly, and making sure that you're not being too aggressive or impolite about it. But setting the boundaries of what that job description looks like, what you're being expected to do, I think is a good first step of knowing about where your boundaries should be. Now, of course, you can adjust and there's exceptions to that rule always. But that's a great jumping off point, is saying, okay, in your contract, it says you work 3 to 7 and you work at this facility with this person for this amount of time. And then anything outside of that, you maybe don't have to give into.
I think that can be so powerful for people and to begin to recognize where there isn't those boundaries and where you are just saying yes to things and not necessarily recognizing whether it's healthy or appropriate to the results you're trying to accomplish to say yes to them. And I think when you talk about job descriptions in that context, I'm not a huge fan of job descriptions. Oh. I like, and I would say that as traditional job descriptions, mm-hmm. because oftentimes you put a lot of effort into writing up a job description and then it changes as soon as yes. you write it. I used to use a tool called an ORG. So it was outcomes, responsibilities, and goals. And it was something we would update on a regular basis. So what are the outcomes you're working towards? Those are like over a couple of years. What are the responsibilities, the tasks, the things you have ownership of? And then the goals are like the specific things you're doing to try to work towards those outcomes. It might be like enter this many orders a week or see this many patients or whatever it is. And I do that definition. So having those clear expectations to understand what is and isn't part of a person's role or responsibility so that they can really take accountability for the things that they know are theirs, the things that are that they have responsibility and accountability for, and be good at doing those, be able to execute them successfully. Because the alternative is people end up taking on potentially a lot more and not actually doing well at all of those things. And then there's negative feedback on performance that really isn't appropriate because the person's doing more than really what should be expected of them.
Yes. And I will say the women tend to be people pleasers. I've seen that more times than not, that women want to take on more. They're people pleasers. They want to help. They want to get things done. They want to be accomplished. So just making sure that it's fair across the board and that those boundaries are really set, like you said, either with some sort of job description and setting those expectations, I think are just so important to help manage how employees are performing and what they're performing on.
I love that you brought that up because I was just recently, I'm going through a neuroscience and neuroperformance and a neuro leadership coaching certification. And they were talking about some of the studies done around inherited behaviors. And so I love that you brought up women because I think when you talk about women want to be of service and they want to do more and they want that desire, I'm not sure is always truly a want so much as it is an ingrained behavior.
Yes.
And we sometimes look at and we can see where maybe that got ingrained in our upbringing and our culture and our neural pathways. But it actually can go back further. And so if you understand generational, you can inherit generational behaviors and behaviors that came from prior generations. And so the studies they've done, like on rats, for example, they've been able to show going back 7 generations that rats will inherit the behaviors of those prior generations. And now that's an extreme example, and it's an example in animals. One of the ones I like to use is, and you can look this up, is putting fleas in a jar. And if you put fleas in a jar and you put a lid on the jar, eventually the fleas will learn that they can't jump out of the jar. And even if you remove the lid, they still won't jump out of the jar. And then when they have offspring, their offspring also won't jump out of the jar because it's a learned behavior. Mm-hmm. They've learned that they can't, and so they actually never try.
Right.
And it's a term called learned helplessness. And I think when you look at women especially, there are these generational behaviors or these behaviors going back centuries. So even though it's maybe not necessarily an expectation in today's society, for example, that women clean up lunch or after an event. That was always my favorite example to use when we did workplace respect training. And in my past life, I was in a super male-dominated process control manufacturing and engineering space. And we had offices in the South, in kind of the Tennessee and Kentucky area, as well as the Midwest. And so there was this cultural, behavioral, unstated expectation that the women in the office would clean up after the lunch or after the company meeting or the and when you challenge that and you ask the question of a lot of women, it really is like it's a programmed I'm supposed to, not necessarily that I want to clean up.
Yes.
The meal, like I have tons of work to get done. Mm-hmm. But I'm expected to. And then when
it's almost automated,
it is. And it's really passed on in our gene sequencing. It's really passed on. And so I think it's a really powerful thing for women, but people in general, to recognize that sometimes our behaviors don't even stem from our personal life experience, that our neural pathways are formed based on our inherited DNA and they start as early as in the womb of our mothers. And so as those are forming, we're inheriting those pathways. We're inheriting the pathways of our parents and our ancestors that came before us. And then those have longer term implications that seem so small, but really can play out in big ways in terms of additional burden falling on certain members of an organization and not on others.
Yes. And that just really adds, the women typically are expected to do that at home. When you're also expected to do that at work, it adds such another mental stressor that you maybe should not have to deal with at work. So it's just one more thing that you're trying to manage and keep under control and just really try to improve and have a healthy set boundaries. And once you get not only the genders, the generations, the older generation are going to have more traditional values, whereas the younger generations have these whole new set of these boundaries and expectations of what they think that this should look like. So you get those 2, 3, 4 generations together. And it's really interesting to see how those different tasks and expectations play out in the workplace.
When it all starts with, I think, as you're talking about it, with just becoming aware of that,
yes.
Right? Of just becoming aware of why are these the people that are always the ones cleaning up? And actually, I remember when I trained our organization and we used that example, how quickly certain, not all, but other certain men in the office began stepping up.
Wow.
And it was in an almost immediate shift of, oh my gosh, it really shouldn't just be them. Mm-hmm. And they changed their behavior and it became this much more balanced, like different people volunteering to help clean up after different events. And it was this immediate shift and the executive leaders actually led it and said, okay, you're right. Like we need to lead the way. And they were male leaders. It shouldn't just be that because these are female members of our company, they're the ones that are doing this, or they're the ones with responsibility for this. And that really changed the dynamic significantly, yeah. Right? There was a lot of shared respect and shared responsibility. But it all starts with that awareness. It starts with, okay, why is it this way? Mm-hmm. Why do I feel this way? So as a woman, why do I feel bad if I walk away and don't help clean up? Mm-hmm. But then all these others don't feel bad. And
right.
Just having that dialogue and that awareness is the foundational element of it, right?
Mm-hmm. And so often I see that it's not malicious. It's not people trying to be rude or disrespectful or whatever, you're not wanting to help. It's just, you don't think about it. It's so ingrained in who we are and in our traditions and, like you were saying, in our genes and how we were brought up, that it's just automatic. And so making that situation aware and those tasks aware can be such a jumping off point of just changing even the culture. That's got to really help the culture of the women feeling more appreciated and helped. And just having that conversation can really improve so many situations before they end up blowing up and becoming a bigger problem.
And then what's beautiful is, you know, we're wired to operate the way that we are because of the neural pathways, the connections in our brains and bodies and all the different neural networks that have formed. That's what creates what we do. And we do most of what we do is actually unconscious. In fact, there are studies that show that our brains make decisions 10 seconds before we become conscious of them. So the parts of our brain will light up around a decision or an action we're going to take before we're even aware that we're going to take that action.
Wow.
And it makes sense because in order to be able to live and respond and deal with everything, we can't consciously think about every single thing,
right?
About every step we're taking and breathing and all of the things that we do. We can't be conscious of everything. And so our brains are analyzing all the information and all the experiences and all those neural pathways. And then that comes out in behavior and action in what we do. And what's so great is in the last 20 years, we know that not only is there neuroplasticity, that we can change those pathways throughout our entire lives, but there's also neurogenesis, which means that we can create new neurons, new neural pathways altogether. Mm-hmm. We can create and actually grow new ways of thinking and being. And so we're not stuck with that we have to be this way. So we become aware of it. And then we learn, if we can learn how to apply the neuroperformance approach, how to apply that neuroscience to our performance and to what we're doing, that we can change ways of being that aren't serving us or that we don't like feeling like we have no boundaries or that we are doing things that we shouldn't have to be doing or that we're overworked and overwhelmed. All of those pathways can be changed, but it starts with awareness and then learning how to do it.
Yes. And one of the things I stress both at home and in the workplace, and it's funny to me because when I say this, there's still light bulb. I've seen so many people's just little light bulbs go off. You can set boundaries and expectations kindly. It doesn't have to be this big, aggressive, confrontational thing, because that's where a lot of the boundaries get broken is they want me to do it. And I don't want to cause confrontation. You don't have to cause confrontation. You can politely state what your boundary is, make sure it's followed through with, and change that behavior. So just saying that you can set these boundaries politely, kindly, in a nice way. You don't have to, you know, be confrontational about it. It's really great to see the change in behavior in those light bulbs of both employees and my family. And then to see that applied and that change behavior. And then all of a sudden you see them being a little less stressed out, a little more happy, a little bit more tense. And it's because they're learning how to set those boundaries in an appropriate way. And that's working for them. And that's just great to see. It's so great to be able to help and improve where we can in employees' lives.
And all of that kind of stems out of that self-awareness and that emotional intelligence, right? Understanding the experience that we're having and recognizing the emotions that we have in our bodies and the experience that we're having. And we actually have one of the tools that we use is one of our partners is called Vibonics. And we have an app that allows you to use voice recognition to identify what emotions you're experiencing.
Oh, how neat.
And what you find is that often people are not aware of their own emotions.
Yes.
That we're experiencing a lot of things all of the time and that we've gotten really good at blocking those messages in order to cope, in order to just keep going, and when we do that, then we're not able to take the actions, the boundaries, the shifts, the have them those conversations where we're providing that clarity that we could have to create better results. We're not able to have those because we're not even really aware of the experience that we're having and the impact it's having on us.
Yes, that is very interesting. I have not heard of that. I would love to look into something like that.
It's really powerful, and it makes, especially when people are working on their performance and making shifts in their performance, having an understanding of those emotions that are existing within underneath the surface goes a long way to then being able to identify and rewire the neural pathways in order to create different results and outcomes.
I will say similarly, when I was in my undergrad, I studied micro expressions, very similar to what you're saying about attitude, because your face will show, and it's just a brief expression, but your face will show what you're truly feeling, and being able to recognize that and see that in others can really help communication and improving that communication with somebody else by knowing how they feel. All of that is very interesting and helping, and really goes back to, again, being aware and understanding and recognizing what you're seeing and feeling.
And I think I raise a really important point too, in that so much of our communication is actually nonverbal, and that the way that our face muscles operate are all unconscious cues to people that we're communicating and interacting with, and can trigger our nervous system. So even if a person is saying the right things, if they don't have the emotional intention behind them, or it's disingenuous, even if it seems like they are saying the right things, it feels misaligned to us. Like we pick up on that, and it can trigger our safety defenses. It can put us into a fight or flight or a freeze mode of, I don't trust this person, something's not right. And that has a major impact on relationships and ability to work together.
Yes, body language is such a huge factor in how we feel and what we understand. That's often the reason for some conflict through email and text, because you don't have that body language. And while sometimes that's a good thing, depending on what you're trying to say, a lot of the time you need that context to really understand, oh, this person isn't attacking me. This person isn't trying to be rude or mean, or it just, some people are direct, or the way they said it isn't the best. But seeing that body language can really help improve that communication as well.
And it's interesting because the email communication, electronic communication in general has increased the rate of communicating, right? The rate of, or I should not say communicate, the rate of information being sent and received, but maybe negatively impacted the true communication of understanding of the message.
Yeah.
And so simply because someone has the information doesn't mean they've received the communication.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And I think that alone can really be the crux of a lot of challenges that we're experiencing in our workplaces, but in our world in general.
Yeah.
Is that simply having the information is not the same as having received the communication.
Yes.
And receiving the communication requires some deeper level of understanding, particularly when you're talking about complex, important, strategic, relationship-based types of situations and scenarios.
Yes. What another thing I advocate for with being such a remote team is pick up the phone. If you see an email and you're not sure of the intention behind it, just pick up the phone and take that extra step to go a little bit further, be a little bit kinder, and really see what that intention is. Another great resource that I've been told and used personally is if you get an email or a text and it upsets you for whatever reason, sit on it for 24 hours. You don't have to respond right away, or an hour even. Take a moment, collect your thoughts. And if you don't want to pick up the phone and if you're not comfortable with that, at least take a moment before you respond off that emotional response that you initially got from reading that communication.
You know what I would love to see even one step further than picking up the phone? Now that we have such technology like video messaging, the Marco app and the WhatsApp and all that kind of stuff, to be able to send a brief video recording of just, hey, here's my question for you. So you don't have to do it live. You don't have to necessarily connect live, but you get to see a person's expressions. You get to see that communication and communicate back in maybe a non-live, an asynchronous way, but have that visual. And I think as I've used that technology, especially around relationships and friendships that I've developed and things like that, it has made such a huge difference because it's just more impactful when you can see someone's face than when you can't. And I think it's underutilized in the workplace, and it actually is faster than typing out an email.
Yes.
Like figuring out what you're going to say in an email. If instead all I have to do is say, hey, here's what I'm thinking, I'm not sure, whatever, you can convey all of your intention around it so much more effectively when you're doing it in a recording.
Yes. And it cracks me up when I go on these human resources that are really just in general. I see these memes that say you're having a work meeting and your camera's off, and the manager says, put the camera on, and they're in their pajamas with their hair all up in a mess and everything. And it just conveys such the problem of it being underutilized, the cameras being turned on. But it's such an important tool to have with communication and body language that it really should be utilized more than it is.
Yeah. I have loved this conversation so much. I so appreciate you coming on today. I want to give you a chance to give any final thoughts that you have or words of wisdom that you have for our listeners around the things that we've talked about or just in general that you'd like to share with them today.
Yeah, it was a pleasure being here. I'm honored that I was asked to be. And just final thoughts, I think, is don't assume the worst in people and really take care of your mental health and set those boundaries and utilize your EAP program. Even if you don't think you have one, ask your human resource person and just reach out and just utilize it if you're feeling or struggling at work. Set those boundaries and be in a happier, more enjoyable mental state.
I think I love what we've talked about today, and I love that advice. And I think that the key part of that is getting into a place of action. Awareness and action, of getting to a place where you're more aware of your experiences, of your responses, of your behaviors and actions and the things that you're doing so that you can then take action on shifts and changes and ways of being that maybe will positively impact your life in ways that you haven't considered before. And I think when we do that, when we can learn how to rewire those neural pathways to understand the emotions that we're experiencing, to set new boundaries and have new experiences, we can create workplaces and cultures that just far surpass what people are experiencing today. And there's so much opportunity. There's so much space for improvement in small things that can make just a huge difference if we understand how humans operate in the neuroscience of human performance. So as we wrap up today's episode, I just want to remind our listeners to always keep evolving, keep growing, keep looking at how you can rewire those neural pathways so that you can create more exceptional experiences in your life, on your life journey, so that one day you can look back on your life and say, I lived an exceptional life. I had a great life. And hopefully your workplaces can one day be a part of that experience. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day and your week, and we'll be back again next week with another episode. Have a wonderful day.